Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Cadenac, and joining me today is 2014 IndyCar champ Will Power. Will, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
And we're here talking about the sheer force of Will Power, the new book, and I learnt so much from this book. In your chair, we had Mark Webber in a couple of months ago, and I'm now a converted race car fan, just because I realise now, and this book I think is probably the best example of that, of how much work goes into even being on the grid, let alone being a champion.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, and all the sacrifices we were talking about before, I mean, do you constantly look back at that now that you're sort of right up there in the world standings, and do you often reflect on the sacrifice people made for you? And you made yourself for that.
Yeah, I just, it was something I didn't realise until I took motorsport very seriously, how much it took to be the best at something.
Mm.
And, you know, in the world of motorsport, you've not only got to be a very good driver and study driving and understand how to be, you know, super fast, because that's the only way you're going to make it. You've also got to understand the, you know, the whole system of finding financial backing to pay for your racing all the way up until you become a professional, which costs not just a few hundred thousand, but you're talking, you know, in the $1 million.
Well, that's in the book. We're talking millions. It's amazing.
Yeah. And so it was, for me, being a very shy person, having to meet people all the time that were going to help me financially get to the point that I need to be, to get to each step. It was just amazing. Like each step, it felt like an absolute roller coaster ride in our household every Christmas, wondering, you know, what am I going to do? It's just this obsession I had with wanting to make it. And it was often stressful and, you know, sleepless nights, I guess, but just the persistence, and I just can't believe I actually made it when I look back. I really can't. Like the funding I had to raise to get to each step, you know, if I looked back, like in 2000 when I started taking it seriously, if I looked at the next 5 years, say, and saying this is how much money I need to do to make it to this point, I would never in a million years say that was possible. Never.
Yeah.
And just incrementally you make it. It's a different track for every driver. That was my story.
Mm.
Some drivers have it very easy. They get picked up by a manufacturer or someone like Red Bull,
yep,
and it's all paid for.
Yeah.
I had to find, you know, little bits here and there, some from the family, some from, you know, this guy I met, and, you know, Mark Webber helping me, and it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, and the theme, I guess, within that hard work is you're not just selling yourself as a driver, but ultimately you're selling yourself as a product and people are investing in you from a sponsorship standpoint.
You've got to, that was the thing for me is, you know, I wasn't the type of guy that a sponsor would like, I guess, as far as public speaking and presenting myself well.
But that's,
you know, I was pretty shy.
But I think that's in the book, because there's constant referrals of there's just no bullshit with Will, and that seems quite foreign in the motorsport world.
That wasn't me. You know, the bullshit that you, as you call it, that you have to.
But the book says it. Right? I'm not into potty mouth on this podcast.
No, I know what you mean. You know, and that was the way I was brought up in Toowoomba. And you know, you didn't bullshit. You know, you know what it's like in a corporate company in that type of environment. It's very different from where I grew up working for my dad down the back. You know, having to be very well spoken, just not be nervous and speak in front of people and that type of thing. That's not my style. But also, I'm not heavily into bullshit. You know, talking. You know, just get to the point, and you know, that's very basic, but that's how I was. You know, obviously you grow and evolve as a person as you get older, but at that stage in my career, you could call it I was just basically down the line.
No, it's good, and I think that's one of the really endearing parts about it, is that we all know. I grew up with kids that went on to play AFL or rugby league or things like that, and that one defining thing was they were so determined. It's fascinating. So now, from that determined kid growing up in Toowoomba, I mean, you're a, I don't know what you like walking on the streets here, but you're a bona fide celebrity. Most places you go now with the Indy cars, I want to talk about Indy 500 because it just blows my mind, the crowd and everything like that. But
yeah,
how do you cope from someone who had to work so hard to get people to notice them, to plug money into you, yeah, and now someone who I assume probably gets money thrown at them with endorsements and things like that?
Yeah, it's amazing the swing in having to find money to getting paid. It's just amazing that actually happens in a sport like motorsport. But yeah, I still like to keep to myself and keep low key.
Mm.
But obviously at the end of the day, it is, at this stage in my career, you somewhat start thinking about when you retire and you've got to, continually make income to live well, or if you have to do something. But I the whole fame thing, and when I'm in Indianapolis and you go out to dinner and people look at you, for me that's very awkward.
Yeah,
I find it very kind of, I don't know, it's just I would hate to be super famous, put it that way. Imagine being Brad Pitt or something. I mean, that would be terrible. You couldn't actually go out and just be normal.
That's true. Yeah. I think there's a whole Heineken ad campaign about the awful thing about being famous.
Yeah.
So, but let's talk about the most famous event on the Indy calendar.
Yes. Yeah.
Indianapolis. Because as soon as I read your book, I had to remind myself of how crazy it is, because I went and did Google Images. So there's about 250,000 people that'll be watching that race. Is that the crowd?
Millions
on at home, but there's
yes, a quarter. Yes, but at the track, yeah. It's incredible. Biggest sporting event in the world, basically. Yeah. The biggest single day sporting event in the world. It amazed me the first year I did that in 2008. I didn't realize, just it was a whole month event, and the media attention and just the sheer amount of people every day. You're testing there, pretty much every day of the month, and it's just always people waiting outside the garages looking for autographs and getting, wanting pictures and so on. That goes on the whole month.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And then race day is the most amazing thing. It blows you away when you actually walk out onto the grid through Gasoline Alley, just to see you've tested that whole track all month with no one basically in the stands.
Yep.
Like people there, but to fill 250,000 seats,
yeah,
or it seats 300,000, I mean,
it's just a wall of noise at that point.
It's amazing atmosphere. The first time I walked out, and just that sound of so many people and just the look of so many people, it just amazes me.
Yeah.
Amazes me. It still does when you walk out there on race day. It's just amazing. And then you do the parade lap. It's just a sea of color for the first time all month on race day.
Yeah.
And it's very, that whole month is just wears on you by the time you get to the race. Last year I did it, or this year was the first time that I actually kind of enjoyed it,
yeah,
and had my best result, which was second, close second, almost won it.
Yeah.
I think that makes a difference. You got to kind of embrace it instead of, the PR, all the media and PR stuff you do all month kind of wears you down a bit. But this month I kind of took it more lightly and enjoyed it.
Yeah. Is the Indianapolis worth the extra points with the new system they've brought in?
Indianapolis, yes, it's worth double points.
So I think this is a good segue to talk about coming into the 2014 race, where they had it in the books describing that in another year, coming into the final race, you're home clear, you're fine, you're the champion.
Yes.
But they've brought in these new
double
points. Can you talk us through that?
I hated the double points.
Oh, it sounds awful.
Because it's not... Like, why should one race pay more than the other?
It pays about the same as seventh in another race, doesn't it? Is that right? First in one race will be like seventh at one of these double points.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's probably, if you add it up, it'd be, because obviously to win was 100 points, and then it probably does go down to about 50, which is seventh place. But frustrated me when I got to the end of that season, knowing that I should be champion now. Mm. I should be going the last race feeling very comfortable. Instead, it's like, yep, if something goes wrong, you can lose a championship against. I remember the weeks leading up to that, and I just was driving my wife crazy, not sleeping, and just saying, if I lose a championship because of double points, I'll be so angry. But it worked out, obviously.
Yeah.
But I'm not a fan of double points. I really am not. And you know, I hope they change that to come double the prize money, not the bloody points.
It just seems crazy. And there's more things that happened there. I mean, there was an earthquake.
There was an earthquake in Sonoma. I was just lucky the guy that I was fighting the championship was staying in that hotel at the time. Yeah. And that's the one that got hit the hardest. You know, I think we were right there at the epicenter of it. Absolutely destroyed the hotel. I truly did think I was going to die. Like, when I woke up, how violent that was and the glass smashing, I was like, I didn't even register until it stopped that it was an earthquake. I mean, you know, 3:30 a.m. on race day to be standing outside the hotel, you know, evacuated.
Yeah.
And thinking, you know, I'm thinking that.
And you still think double points, this wouldn't matter.
Yeah. At the same time. That's true. Yeah. And, you know, it's, I'm thinking the race isn't actually going to be on.
Yeah,
of course.
Because
I'm thinking the track's going to be destroyed, but in fact, the track was however many miles away and it wasn't affected very much. So, everything, I drove in the track that morning and everything was going as normal. I'm like, okay, we're racing and I haven't slept. But Elio also hasn't slept, so he's a guy I'm fighting. That's all right. And when you get woken up with such a shock like that, I was actually drove a really good race up until I made that mistake, but I was on, like, absolutely on my game.
Yeah, and that's, I think, reading it now, and people give me a bit of shite because I sort of soak myself in sports and know a lot of sort of nerdy stats, but I would now, after reading your book, comfortably put that as one of the most amazing achievements I've seen, because there were so many things. There's two we're talking about here. People were saying after the previous race, you know, he's choked, he's losing it. I mean, all the variables to bring it home. You must have been terrified when you just... And then, even then, if you're... It's 3:30 in the morning and in your head you're thinking, I might not even be racing today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that's going to be one less race. Is that a good or a bad thing for points? I'm thinking to myself. And I was kind of like, no, it's not a good thing because I was on pole position. Like, I qualified first, so that means I had a better chance of pulling a bigger gap on Elio. So going to the finale, I have a better chance. So, you know, it was amazing trying to block, and I did that well, actually, is to block out the media saying that he'll choke again and that's what's happening. And finishing runner-up three times puts that pressure in your mind that people are saying that, so you don't need to read it. And I try to keep that out as much as possible. I didn't want to know what the points would have been. I kind of asked and just said, no, I don't want to know. I'm not looking at points this year. I don't want to know. I just want to, just every race for what it is, I'm going to take it. There's no thought of, you know, thinking about the points during the race. It's just a bad idea.
Yeah. One chapter in the book I want to talk about is the Team Australia, because it seems like it was a massive part of your career as well, and it's spoken of really, really warmly with you and people around you, directors. There's some great parts. So tell me about the Team Australia experience.
Yeah, Team Australia was, I guess, a big break for me, because it was a transition from paying for racing to getting paid, it was in pretty cool race cars. It was, I had to make the decision to say, I'm not going to make it to Formula One, but I'm going to take a deviation. I'm going over to America to race, and that wasn't the traditional path that you would take if you were going to try and make it to Formula One. So that was definitely a big break for me. You know, they'd already been running for 1 year, Team Australia, and I got the call from, it was actually Derek Walker, Derek Walker and Craig Gore and John Fish were the guys who created this team. It was mainly Craig Gore and John Fish on the Australian side of things, and Derek Walker owned the team. And, Walker had me come and test there in 2005 and did a really good job of that test, was really fast, and he's thinking, this is our guy. And then basically did not finish the season that I was in, which is World Series by Renault in Europe, to go and race the last two races of 2005 in with Team Australia in Champ Car, which is basically IndyCar, but the split faction of it. And that was, great. It was just unbelievable to get a contract that was 3 years long and not have that, it was actually a massive relief.
Yeah.
To not have that feeling of, okay, I can prove myself really well in 3 years, whereas I was on the chopping block every year for a 1-year deal, you've got to prove yourself this year. That gave me a little bit more
breathing
space, you could say, or so I thought. But obviously things in motorsport always change.
Yeah. And Derek Walker seems like is a fascinating character in this book as well. Can you describe the relationship? Because it was mental, but in all the time he's just throwing you, saying, this is the guy. Like, this is the guy who's going to lead us through the way. And maybe in those early days it maybe felt like... But in the book, definitely, it feels like he was a huge champion of yours for most of your career in the early days.
Derek was a very good talent scout. Like, he really could... Honestly, I mean, some of the people that he's picked during his career as a team owner have gone on to... You know, Gilles Deferrin, who was a two-time champion and Indy 500 winner... Yeah, Derek picked that guy. Pagano is my teammate now, and he was just very good at that. Is picking the right drivers and picking the right crew. Like, for the budget that he had, he did the best job in pit lane. Yeah. A very small operation, but really, really efficient and effective. And Derek was a true, what you call a true racer. He was all about the performance, not trying to bank money and, you know, from sponsors and so on. He was about, you know, how can we win races with what we've got and use everything to do that. And that's what I love about Derek.
Yeah. And there's a lot of forks in the road part in your career, I guess, as anyone who's successful is. But I guess I never really thought about it, but when you talk there about the transition of going across to the IndyCar side, going to the States instead of the UK, and there's a part that you say, I don't know if you quoted or if it's a reference, but you say, I'd rather be out front of IndyCar than, and this is in the book, it's brilliant, than wanking away in the middle of Formula One, which I think is a really, that's very bold. It was a bold decision to make.
I can't remember if I actually...
If you had, someone's written wanking in your book, I think it's an issue. Well, if that's...
exactly.
Yeah.
I can't remember saying that. That's actually true, though. You could spend your career in the middle of the field or in Formula One and never win a race your whole career, or you can be in IndyCar and always have a chance of winning every weekend. Yeah. No matter what team you're in, you would have a shot.
Yeah.
So, there's something to be said for that. But, I can't remember if I said that. Was that my quote?
I don't know. We can have a look up there. I've done the word search, I find that just seems like such a, I don't know, it's such a huge decision to make still. And it feels comfortably now like you made the right decision, but at the time, for a kid growing up always seeing F1 as being the final, you did test driving with Will Davidson, is that right?
I test drove the Minardi with Will Davidson. Just blew me away.
Yeah, it was awesome.
But I still did another year in Europe after that.
Yeah.
So I was still, my mind was still on Formula One. I just needed to get that break, but the break came in America, not in Europe.
Yeah. So, and probably the last thing when we talk about Formula One, one of the things you say about that car is your amazing its ability to accelerate, but also to brake on corners. Yes. And when we talk about motor racing, it would be silly not to talk about the courage that it takes to actually race those cars. And there's a couple of incidents in here where people have lost their lives. I mean, where is your head at now? Is it just you go through the motions, or in the back of your mind is safety always just this little voice on your shoulder saying, this is dangerous?
Believe me, it's always there. And it's something that you really have to switch out when you get in the car. Just recently, obviously, another driver was killed. Very recently. And I knew this guy very well, obviously, with Dan Weldon in the book. I couldn't even read the chapter that was written about Weldon because it was in my season and it just upset me too much. I did the interview with David for it, and he wrote it, and my wife read it and started reading it, and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah,
because it's obviously, from what I saw, you know, that's something that affected me badly for a while. I ended up sitting looking at the guy, Dan, with what happened to him.
Yeah,
Sitting there, basically, he was killed. That affects you badly for forever, probably. But yeah, you're right. It's something that is just weighs on you. It's the fact that, in our sport, people are still getting killed, too often.
Mm.
And you know, to me it's not good enough, and I'm really really an advocate for safety, and I pushed that very hard within the series. And after this last one, you know, hopefully there will be some changes. But yep, it's dangerous, it's fast, you know, when you're averaging, you know, obviously we're talking mile an hour, it's, you know, when we qualified Indy now, it's, you know, you're doing 240 mile an hour on the straight, so that's got to be 300 and, you know, you turn it wide open into a corner at 300 and close to 380, it's going to be 380. God, something happens, like my teammate this year, he spun, and the thing just took off backwards up in the air, like way up in the air. I mean, it's just that type of thing that you've got to be on top of. I mean, it's just, I always think about, you can minimize the risk in many ways in practice and testing and which moves you make. I mean, you can, you know, it's got to be very calculated, and you've got to really, it's got to be 100%. It's not going to be a half, you know, can I make it, can I not? I think if you have that attitude, you'll end up having some big crashes. And that just comes with experience. So yeah, it's, that weighs on my mind heavily, the whole safety aspect, it just does.
Yeah, of course. Well, look, congratulations again on everything with this book. It's fascinating when we talk about the courage that goes into just doing it, but the actual journey towards even getting anywhere near the grid is, it's quite inspirational, if I don't want to say. Well, so congratulations. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And remember, at home, you can get The Sheer Force of Willpower at booktopia.com.au right now. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.